The views expressed in this podcast are solely those of the speaker. This podcast is for informational purposes only and is not a substitute for professional medical advice from your own physician.
Hi, everyone. My name is Tobias Matei. I serve as the deputy editor of the North American Spine Society Journal. And I have the honor of having today in our podcast, Dr. Jared Ament. Dr. Jared is a neurosurgeon and he works at Cedars-Sinai in LA. And he's the first author of an article recently published in the North American Spine Society Journal entitled Intraoperative Neuromonitoring Spine Surgery, a Large Database Analysis of Cost Effectiveness. Thank you very much for your presence today, Jared. Would you like to introduce yourself, maybe a little bit of your practice to give our listeners some background of your work and maybe of your research?
Sure. Pleasure. Thank you for having me. It's a great honor to always discuss kind of the research and the work that we kind of poured blood and sweat and tears into. So it's a nice opportunity. So thank you. What can I tell you about me? I mean, born and raised in Toronto, Canada, but I've been in the United States for 25 years. I continue to do a lot of international work with NGOs and various research organizations, one in particular, Solidarity Bridge, I'm the director of research for. My partner is Amir Vokshur, based in Santa Monica at St. John's. He's the chief of surgery at St. John's now. We have a group entitled Neurosurgery and Spine Group. Most of my practice is either at Cedars in Los Angeles or in the Valley, West Valley, West Hills Hospital in Tarzana. And our group is unique, we'd like to think so, because although we do a lot of spine and we're big proponents of artificial disc replacement and creating registries and the research around kind of the cutting edge new approaches and ways to make this a available technology, one of the things we really strive to do is make it a little bit of a private demic practice. We have a research organization. My partner and I have something called the Institute of Neuroinnovation. It's a nonprofit dedicated really to, strive towards providing the best possible care for our patients, as I know all of our colleagues want to do. But we really want to try and create research paradigms around all of that. And one of the important parts about what we do is, how do you mitigate risk? How do you make sure that the technologies that become available or have been available are sustainable? Because those are real considerations. And the other part of our practice that's kind of unique is we're very kind of integrative. We're functional. We really want to look at the nervous system, brain and spine holistically. We integrate what's called the Neurovella Brain Spa into our practice. Patients go for pre and post-operative meditation sessions where we hook them up with theta wave, light frequency stimulation, and really look at kind of opiate use and measure certain metrics objectively as well as subjective PROs to see how patients do compared to controls that never had this kind of brain spa experience. We really try to integrate our practice that way. And I guess that makes us a little bit unique. But one of the things that's relevant to this particular paper, I guess my background, the pertinence is I went to Harvard School of Public Health, where I had the great fortune of training under someone by the name of Milt Weinstein. Now, Milt Weinstein, most doctors and surgeons don't know, and I would never have known either, but he is basically the godfather of cost effectiveness, cost utility. He wrote the original panels and books that were used actually at the United Nations and the WHO as guiding kind of resources for how to conduct cost-effective analysis around the world, not just domestically. And when I first started doing this type of work, I was actually based in Boston and I was traveling with groups, research groups out of Harvard, trying to figure out how to make technology accessible in the non-industrialized world, in the non-industrialized setting. How do we make some of the American technologies that we're accustomed to available to the third world? What I realized is when I came home and I sort of advanced in my career is we have the same problem here. It's just at a different scale and it's just at a different level. We want the next greatest cancer drug that costs $350,000, per injection, but doesn't sustain life more than a month or two. But is a month or two quality? What type of injection is this? What does it do? What does it give? Is the patient debilitated during this time? Are they truly functional? Can they attend their granddaughter's wedding? I mean, there are all kinds of questions that we have to answer. And I mean, it's an, you know, the age old question, even in surgery, is just because you can do something doesn't mean you should. So if you spend $1 million on something, I'm not saying that it's not valuable and saving someone's life for 1 month or 2 months isn't important. What I'm saying is we can't do that and expect to provide a high level of care to everyone if we run out of resources. There are scarce resources, and we need to make sure that we offer the best level of care sustainably. And that's kind of where the impetus for this and other papers that I've worked on came from, is how do we, you know, use technology responsibly? How do we invest in our healthcare responsibly so that everyone can enjoy? You know, again, I babble a little bit, but it is a truth, sad truth or just a truth, but it's a truth nonetheless, that more money is spent on healthcare during the end of life phase of your care than most people spend their entire life in medicine. And it's an important concept, because in the United States, you know, our grandma is the most important person to us at the moment. And I get it. I love my grandma, but it's, you know, when she's 98 years old and lived a good life, should we be spending $2 million or $5 million in ICU costs? It's a really difficult question. When you look at other countries in Europe and Asia, you know, a lot of times the elderly are revered, but they're taken care of. They're brought home, and they're not really put into those situations and become a burden to, you know, facilities or a burden to the system. And so I'm not advocating for one or the other, but I really think it's important that as we push in research and development and we fund all these projects and these trials, it's critical that we, really critical that we just do it responsibly.
Perfect. And taking into account your background in public health, as well as your interest in technology and patient safety, it seems very natural you would address the topic of neuromonitoring spine surgery. And I'll give you a little bit of my perspective on that. I'm a little bit biased, and I can tell that I use neuromonitor more than any of the other spine surgeons in my group. And I have a little bit of perspective in terms of neuromonitoring, and we can discuss throughout your results. But I'd like you to give first an introduction to our listeners about your methodology. And one of the things that I would like you to address that for me is very important when we're discussing about neuromonitoring is how we deal. First, I would be curious how you obtain your data, and we're going to discuss some of the models you use. But mm-hmm. I see this is a topic that is a little bit different because we are dealing with rare instances of catastrophic events, and that's known as the black swan effect. So I have mm-hmm. the feeling sometimes that pure average and statistics, they fail to capture sometimes the magnitude of this type of events. So I always tell my residents that, I mean, you can deal with cost-effective analysis, but I mean, if you have something that one case that you can intervene and the incidence, and you have to monitor 30 or 40 or 50 cases to prevent a patient from being quadriplegic the rest of their lives because the cage dislodged. I mean, you can come with the litigation, and we'll address that the paper that you use as your background, because I'm very interested in medical legal research. We have a group that we I'm finishing a law degree, and we have a group exploring some of the legal database, the Westlaw and LexisNexis. And as much as this legal research is interesting, there's a lot of caveats in this type of studies and some of the nuances that I found. But give a little bit of your methodology and how you think that our whole scientific enterprise in terms of statistical analysis and p-values and the null significance hypothesis testing, how appropriate it is when we're dealing with this type of black swan events, and how we can proceed to kind of adjust that to the situations.
Yeah, I think it's a great question. Were you in my statistics course? No, I'm joking. It's a great question. I think statistics is unfortunately imperfect in these scenarios, right? When you have a very low end event such as this, you need very large numbers to kind of look and see if there's any, you know, effect. We were fortunate enough to work with a group called Empower that was actually very interested in the research and supportive of the research, because they actively collect data on all their patients and had a database with you know, 50,000 or more, tens of thousands of patients. And so it's only when you have databases like that that you can do these types of analyses. Now, the analysis does not, thankfully, rely on p-values. So by definition, cost utility, cost effective analysis doesn't require a power calculation, doesn't require p-values. I'm not looking for statistical significance here. What you described and how you kind of train your residents, and I agree with you. You kind of brought up a concept number needed to treat. You know, how many patients do you need to monitor so that you can have an event averted to make it justifiable? Well, you know, philosophically, you and I would argue it doesn't matter. Everyone, right? As long as I avoid one. But I mean, that's philosophical. But, you know, we're not paying for the neuromonitoring, right? It's the hospital, or it's a payer, or it's the insurance company that is actually going to do that. So the question really is, you know, are you going to do something that's sustainable? And does it make sense? Because, you know, we have to make hard choices, unfortunately.
And in terms of your methodology, you mentioned, I agree with you. And one of the things about when I look at cost-effective analysis, and I'm not criticizing any of the assumptions you made in this case to create all the decision trees and the possible scenarios. But honestly, I would like to understand it better. And I think our listeners would benefit from that too, just because I believe that a more nuanced understanding of your data may be not only beneficial to properly apply it, but especially to prevent unwarranted generalization. So you don't want to, right. I don't want anyone to finish your paper and say, okay, we have strong evidence that neuromonitoring is cost effective. So I can argue for that. I mean, I would rather have someone that understand where that data comes from and then have a more critical approach for that. But one of the things that caught my attention, I have in table one, the transition probabilities. And it caught my attention that, for example, for the no intraoperative monitoring alert, we have 100% of bedbound disability. And I think that's the reason for that, correct me if I'm wrong, is what you describe at the end of the methodology that you said that the non-IOM population was not captured in the database. Of course, it's just a database from the IOM. So the probability of postoperative deficits and their incidence were taken from the literature. So my question to you is that, I mean, is it really that any neurological deficits in the patients that are non-neuromonitored, we have to assume that they lead to severe bedbound disability? Or how do you explain that, the fact that you use that number?
Yeah, it's. I think it has to do with the fact that the patients that we see neurologic disability in the literature that are not monitored, it tends to be catastrophic. Now, bedbound disability is, it's an artificial health state. Okay, so you have to understand that based on the methodology, we created health states that are based on ranges. And those ranges, a bedbound health state is, you know, you look at transition probabilities, you mentioned transition probabilities is nothing more than just saying the likelihood of a patient over each follow-up or each period in time to transition from one health state to another. Okay, and so for the bedbound health state is an artificial construct of ranges that we use, that we didn't make it up, but we created these kind of quintile bounds, if you will, of ranges. So where that data fell, we defined it as bedbound. You can use any title you want there. It doesn't have to be bedbound. It could just be severe. We could just use the title severe. But we use that nomenclature. It's not like a publishable nomenclature. We use that nomenclature just to create distinction between the health states. But it could really be mild, minimal, mild, moderate, severe. And how someone, you know, the problem with that, you're right, it's a little bit misleading. It's good to be critical because is it truly bedbound or is it a person with a postoperative C5 palsy that wasn't monitored and the way that data was presented, they were severely disabled, you know, with a C5 palsy because that's how a patient presents themselves if they can't brush their teeth or they can't comb their hair or do, you know, activities of daily living. That could be a severe disability that then gets characterized into that bedbound worst health state. The most important thing when you look at that paper and understanding the health states is simply understanding that it's a range of disability from mild to severe. Yeah. I wanted to just, you asked me to give you a very general understanding of the methodology, which would help people. So I think the most important thing, because you mentioned decision trees, right? And I think the most important thing is to understand the difference between typical decision tree analysis and Markov models, okay? So a decision tree is where you have a starting point, branches, you progress, more branches, and progress. And every time there's a branch, there's a probability of going down a certain branch. Okay, that's simple decision tree analysis. The reason why we, and this is all from Dr. Milt Weinstein, by the way, the reason why we went away from simple decision tree analysis in healthcare was because it was much more fluid. It wasn't that a patient goes from A to B to C. Patients, we realize, and we know this clinically, but there was no statistical methodology to make sense of it. We know that they don't go from A to B to C. Patients go A to B to C to B to A to C, back to A, then sometimes stop in B. If you're talking about levels of health, levels of disability, levels of quality of life, okay? What I'll call utility or disutility, okay? Quality adjusted life years versus disability adjusted life years. So all of these transitions are not decision tree based in the sense that they go from one step to the other. The biggest important distinction is that a Markov model allows us to assess the probability of a patient not transitioning at all. It allows us to assess the probability that a patient can go backwards, not forwards. So that's, it's a little bit, if it's the best that we have and it's imperfect, but it's the most three-dimensional probabilistic model to replicate healthcare that we have. And that's an important distinction.
And one finding of this study that I would like our listeners to be paying attention when they read is that from your results, you find that analyzing the database, your rate of neurological deficits for patients in the non-monitoring group was 4.1% versus 0.3%. That's a huge difference. And I see two possible selection bias there, but I would like you to comment a little bit more on that. One of the issues that we may have is that the patients, we don't know if those patients that were monitored or non-monitored were matched. I mean, it's possible that the surgeons who decided to monitor, they decided to monitor only the most severe cases, which is the tendency for some surgeons. But that would lead to a higher rate of complications or at least a higher likelihood of possible deficits in the monitoring group. So that speaks against the trend you found. The other explanation that could be affecting that is the fact that you found that neuromonitoring was more likely to occur at urban teaching hospitals or tertiary care centers, academic centers. So that maybe, even though the surgeries that are performed in these centers are tend to be more complex, it is possible, for example, that a one-level TLIF has a higher likelihood of disability in a rural center than in the tertiary care center, where some, as the literature shows, that volume is directly associated with outcomes. And I think I remember a paper that showed that the threshold for 50 TLIFs lumbar fusions a year was meaningful in terms of the patient-reported outcomes. So it's not about knowing about the procedure,
absolutely,
but that proficiency.
Yeah, absolutely agree with you. Absolutely. So the selection bias is real, and unfortunately, we had no way to control for it. We certainly didn't have any way to match those populations, right? So this is and again, you want to talk about constructive criticism, and this is a limitation of the work that we do. We are, to avoid generalization, right? We don't want, the generalizability of this data is very hard because we don't have great controls in the non-IOM monitored group. Right, we only have the literature. They're definitely not matched populations, and it's very likely that distinction between the two groups that you just mentioned is not accurate. It's the nuances, the minutiae to compare the neurologic events between IOM and non-IOM group has not really been done. Because it's a very difficult thing to have clinical equipoise unless you go to someone who just doesn't believe in it. And if you have someone who doesn't believe in it, then sure, we should do a trial. But if, it's very hard to find that surgeon willing to do a study on IOM who doesn't believe in it and is going to use IOM. And then, if he's not using it at all. But what it would be really nice if we had the matched controls. But then there's the problem in the course of N. And if you're talking about a neurologic event that at baseline is relatively uncommon, thankfully, and you have a very small population that's matched, what conclusions can we draw? So the only way to get such a large database is to extrapolate from the literature. And so the question we have is, and that's why when you look at the paper, it's almost more important to look at the sensitivity analysis than it is than anything else, because the sensitivity analysis gives us the breadth. It gives us the model discrimination of possibilities. Because we're recognizing that these assumptions are probably inaccurate and fall somewhere in a range, right? And so is it a difference between 0 and 1%? Is it a 0.3 and 7%? Is it somewhere? And we really want to make sure that that range is captured in the sensitivity analysis, which is why the graphical illustrations and the sensitivity analysis, I think, are the most helpful, because it shows using a wide variety of permutations of the covariates that we chose, the likelihood of as many scenarios as possible of IOM being a cost-effective modality. And I think that's the most important takeaway, is the generalizability is about the likelihood. So in certain scenarios, in certain cases, in certain settings, IOM is likely going to be a cost-effective practice. But that's not generalizable to all practices, all settings, all scenarios.
And when you mentioned the sensitivity analysis, I would like to focus a little bit now in the litigation scenarios. As I mentioned, I'm very interested in medical legal research employing the Westlaw and LexisNexis database. And when you cited this paper, I had read it, but I had not noticed that the senior author is Dr. Ehud Mendel. I trained with him, so I did my fellowship with him.
Oh, nice.
It's a very interesting paper, and I hope he's listening to our podcast. Remember, Dr. Mendel, we're the fastest growing spine podcast in the nation. So, and one of the things that I noticed, and it's very similar to what we found in our research, I mean, this type of legal research, it brings a lot of interesting insights. For example, this paper, it came up with the one conclusion that it's almost as likely for you to be sued for negligent monitoring than for not using monitoring, even though they found a little bit of a different range in terms of the settlement. But the title is damn if you do, damn if you don't. I mean, does it really make a difference in terms of the medical legal implications? But one thing that it's very common, I've seen in the two previous publications we had in the previous months, that I always highlight, is that when using any of those databases, it only involves reported cases. So we know that the vast majority of medical legal cases, maybe 80-90%, they settle out of court. Correct. Settle. So these settlements that we're seeing, and I was once asking a law librarian, say, how are we capturing those settlements? What is the mechanism of these settlements? And it's a self-reported settlement. So there's a likelihood that the settlements that we see in this type of database, they're usually the outlier. So it's an attorney, they got a very good settlement, and he just want to make that public in the database. And so it's much more likely that someone is going to record a $10 million win than someone that settled for $200,000 is going to report that. And that explains a little bit the original paper. For example, the settlement value was about $8 million, and the verdict was 4 million. And that doesn't make sense. I mean, if you imagine as a general practice, I mean, the only reason why you settle, it's because you reduce, the plaintiff has a reduction in the uncertainty regarding the outcome. So they accept a lower value than just to have the certainty that they're going to get payment. Instead of going for a possible $10 million, they would rather be happy with a certain $2 million. So I just see that, I mean, in that regard, it's just something that when we discuss how you apply that later, it's just important to have in mind that we're dealing with data, and it's the only data available. I mean, willing or not, that's the only thing we have, is this legal database. And even in terms of the settlement, like if I look at figure 7, I mean, there's a likelihood of both for the negligent monitoring and failure to monitor. And I think the probability of settlement in the negligence was 0.1. And in the failure to monitor, 0.3. So even that decision tree there, I mean, it's based on the reported data, but we know that in reality, it's almost the opposite. I mean, if you're analyzing the likelihood of any action for a neurological deficit involving monitoring, it's much more likely that the 90% of the cases are likely to settle and to litigate. So just give me an idea. I mean, I know you use the data which is available, but how do you see that, for example, if I invert those probabilities in figure 7, do you think it meaningfully affect the data, or how would that affect your conclusions in this study?
Well, this was kind of a sub analysis. We didn't really use, you know, figure seven and the litigation part to draw any major conclusions about, you know, IOM cost effectiveness. And we thought it was an important subsection to include. So it wouldn't affect in our conclusions at all. But, you know, the comment about biased reporting, we actually mentioned that in the paper, I believe, that we talked about how, you know, there is a higher tendency to settle in the non-IOM monitoring cases. And so, and that was clear. And so I think it would be interesting if some of the probabilities were reversed only because it seems to be that people are feeling penalized in the medical legal arena if there happens to be a neurologic event and they weren't monitoring. And so it's almost like hindsight 2020. And so in that scenario, I think it's unfortunate because the data is very interesting because if you would have monitored and they didn't settle, it seems like doctors, for whatever reason, based on the data that was reported, doctors are empowered by monitoring. They feel that they can hide a little bit behind the fact that they monitored and there was no drop in MEPs or there was no change in SSEPs. And therefore, you know, there was no way to have changed their operative course to have averted a neurologic injury. I don't know if it would have affected our conclusion, but it would be nice to see data that was a little bit less weighted on these kind of loose probabilities, but it just doesn't exist. We couldn't find anything. We looked.
For sure. And one of the things when we're discussing about the likelihood of litigation, I agree with you. I have the feeling that, I mean, even in the case that we detect some changes in neural monitoring, the vast majority of cases are cases that, I mean, either there was not a specific surgical action which you could correct, or you decide to observe, I mean, you pay closer attention in the post-op setting. So it's not that they're not valuable, but I always tell my residents that in terms of litigation, we all know spine surgery is associated with some risk of neurological damage. So usually it's not the onset of neurological damage or whatever action happened, but how you dealt with that. So in the case that I've seen, I mean, the most catastrophic circumstances is that you see a change in neuromonitoring and you just continue the surgery without evaluating that. I mean, that's a clear negligent, what do you classify as the negligent monitoring. And I can give you a case, for example, a recent case that I had. I monitor all my spinal stimulation insertion because I do a small incision. So, I mean, first, there's a lot of patients with some degree of stenosis. So I want to make sure that as I'm not doing a full laminectomy, that I can slide the paddle safely without any changes, you know, and that way I can do an outpatient surgery, a very small incision. The other reason is that I like to, we know that if you do that approach, I mean, there's always a tendency for the paddles to slide a little bit to one side, to the other side. So you never have a perfect mm-hmm. x-ray, but the monitor gives you an idea of at least whether you're getting bilateral coverage. So I had a recent case, for example, that when I was ready to insert the paddle, there was a loss of 50% just in the gastric nemius in one leg. I thought that was very interesting. It's just one muscle. We gave some time, bumped the blood pressure, and it came back to about 80% to what it was originally. So the MRI was an elderly patient and there was not severe stenosis. So my decision at that time is should I continue the surgery or not? I said, you know, let's see how real this deficit is. And let me close the wound. And if the patient is completely back to normal tomorrow or in 2-3 days, I'm bringing the patient back to the OR and perhaps increasing a little bit of the laminectomy. And the patient did fine, and we decided to bring it back. I don't know if it would have made a difference if I had placed the spinal stimulation pad at that time. But I can assure you, if that patient had a deficit post-op and I had a spinal stimulation in place, you better settle that for the highest amount that your insurance premium covers, because there's no way you can justify that. It's a small procedure. It's a procedure for pain. You have an alert, or even if you didn't monitor, I mean, you have someone that it's very easy for anyone in hindsight look to that and say, yes, he shouldn't have inserted this pad or should have done a bigger laminectomy. So I still have the feeling that personally, I agree with the perspective at looking as a healthcare for the healthcare system and how should we judicially be employing their monitoring. I think that's a good discussion for those in administrative position. But I mean, at a personal level, I have the option of using neuromonitoring. So I don't use for microdiscectomies, but I use for any fusion that I'm doing. And when I'm doing an ACDF, I monitor the recurrent laryngeal nerve on top of all the modalities, because even though it's unlikely you're going to get a lawsuit for a recurrent laryngeal nerve, I still want to be at least aware during the surgery, move my shadow line retractors. So those are the some considerations that, I mean, regardless of what everyone thinks about neuromonitoring, I think it's a different discussion when you're a provider and it's your liability that you have to deal with. And when you're dealing with the whole healthcare system and deciding if my healthcare system, if we're going to, as a group, use or not neuromonitoring, or if we could save a little bit. But
here's like the concept is interesting because, you know, in the paper where we discussed that one paper about litigation, you know, and I agree with your sentiment. It's one thing to make a choice to monitor or not monitor, but negligent monitoring where you get an alert and you opt not to do something and there's something catastrophic happens. I think that you and I would agree is that's negligence. That's inappropriate practice, malpractice. But a lot of people, in my opinion, will use these kind of litigation scenarios and say, well, I'm better off just not monitoring because then I don't have to pay attention to an alert because I don't want to be criticized for not managing the alert appropriately. Whereas, you know, in my training in neurosurgery, for the neurosurgery boards, it was like bread and butter. You had to know how to manage a drop in MEPs if that happens intraoperatively. That's part of the boards, you know? And so I don't want litigation analyses and cost analyses to deter people from using something that can help them. Now, if they truly believe there's no value, you know, there's been papers that go back and forth in terms of utility, but, you know, I find it hard to believe that people in practice that use neuromonitoring won't at least let something guide their decision making. So it can be annoying. You may have a drop in a signal, you do everything, nothing changes, patient wakes up, patient's fine. You're like, why the hell did I just spend an extra 30 minutes? Right. But I really believe there are, and this is the hard part to tease out, which is why we offer so many vast ranges. And I steer back to kind of the willingness to pay threshold and the probabilistic analysis in our paper, the ranges of scenarios that are cost effective. Because if you're going to use monitoring and you're going to get some alerts, some of those alerts will be false positives for sure. But the ones that are true, and those annoying ones, but the ones that are true positives and you make a corrective action and the patient wakes up, okay, now again, this is the other corollary, right? You make a corrective action, the patient wakes up, okay, or a patient doesn't and wakes up with a deficit, or you don't know if what you did anything, but the patient wakes up okay. So it's impossible to isolate every point in time and control it. You cannot do a proper randomized trial here and control for every factor. That's the problem. You don't know that if you raising the blood pressure, if you decompressing a little bit more, and the MEPs maybe never came back, but the way the patient wakes up fine, objectively, clinically fine. Was it inaccuracy of the monitoring? Was it your surgical maneuver? It is impossible to isolate. There are two, you know, in statistics, it's called confounding, right? There are too many confounding factors here to know exactly. And so when I look at litigation, it's like, okay, so cost of negligence was lower than the cost of failure to monitor. I mean, it's because of the settlement cost. There's so you can't control what one lawyer fights for in arbitration and settlements. And there's too many variables that are, that's why we didn't come to any conclusions really on the litigation. We just thought it was interesting to present. That it neuromonitoring was helpful in some scenarios, but not all. And that one reason it couldn't be helpful in all scenarios from a litigation perspective was either the sheer size of settlements or the variability of the settlements in different scenarios. So, you know, I really draw the readers, if anyone is interested in kind of cost effective, and please reach out, by the way, I think my email is listed, but I mean, please do. But if anyone's interested, you look at the best point estimates you can based on the databases or the literature that you can. And you create reasonable ranges and talk about assumptions around models. All models have assumptions, reasonable ranges, so that you and I may disagree on the 0.3 versus 4% difference, but we may agree on the 1 versus the 3% difference. As long as those ranges are within reasonable assumptions And we can do the analysis and determine an ICER, an incremental cost effectiveness ratio, that suggests there's value for a certain dollar spent in a majority of cases, in greater than 50% of cases, then the argument here, and I say this about all the work that I do in cost effectiveness, it's not a conclusion, it's an argument that there's value in paying attention to this technology or this modality because it may be, one, good for healthcare, good for the patient, and two, it may be cost effective, it may be sustainable. And that's really kind of the crux of this type of paper and this argument when it comes to intraoperative neuromonitoring.
And I think one of the data that is important, like as a take-home message, is that, I mean, we may disagree, and I found some literature estimating the cost of neuromonitor of $2,000 to $4,000. I think in your case, it was about $1,500. But the fact is that in all scenarios, and please correct me if that's that I'm getting that wrong, but in all scenarios, neuromonitor had only a very small marginal increase in the cost of the procedure, to the point that it never extrapolated between beyond the $100,000 per quality adjusted life years. So if that's our thresholds in all the scenarios you had, I mean, it seems that the overall cost was $60-something per quality, and with or without neuromonitoring. So it was not neuromonitoring that would transition from a procedure that was reasonably acceptable to something that goes beyond the validated threshold in the literature for any investment in healthcare. Do you agree with that?
Completely. Yeah. I mean, the take-home message, people get caught up on these dollars per $60,000 per quality and what ICERs and economic dominance and, you know, and economic dominance. I mean, people are like, oh, it wasn't dominant. I mean, economic dominance, just for the listeners, is the concept that you get more value, more healthcare utility for less money, right? The best bang for your buck. But let's be honest, most things in life don't work like that. You have to pay more to get more, right? So the concept of cost effectiveness, the fact that we can show some dominance sometimes in some scenarios is nice. And I think that that's very exciting, but it's not realistic, right? If you're gonna pay more, you expect that you're getting more. And in this case, the idea is neurologic injury averted and better health states overall. And the only reason we can assume that would occur in general is because surgeons made intraoperative decisions based on the neuromonitoring that affected more neurologic complications. And so the ICER is always relative to societal norms, right? Cataract surgery, one of the most cost-effective surgeries in the world, depending on where you are, somewhere between $3,000 per quality and $15,000 per quality, on average, like $9,000-$10,000 per quality. Okay. Pediatric cardiac surgery is something like $350,000 per quality. But who's not going to do pediatric cardiac surgery if the child needs it, right? So it's all about, you know, normative data, societal norms and tolerances. And for us, in the United States, the commonly accepted willingness to pay threshold is $100,000 per quality. That does not mean you're spending $100,000. It's really important that the listeners understand that. It's $100,000 per quality adjusted life year. Okay. And that's a really important distinction to give. Where did these willingness to pay thresholds come from? Where did the data really originate? Again, back to the, you know, Milt Weinstein, you know, era in, you know, the 70s, 80s, 90s, we started thinking about what is considered the minimum acceptable threshold in the United States. And at the time when these things were being developed, it was dialysis, believe it or not. It's patients suffering from end-stage renal disease. Why? Because if you don't get dialysis, you die. So that was a very clear-cut intervention that society at the time, American society determined was the minimum acceptable for whatever that expense was. And that value at the time came to $50,000 per quality. And that's what it was worth. And now this has been many decades since most of the literature would say it's $100,000 to $150,000 per quality. But it's all relative, right? And so would a system like a Kaiser or the Providence or a big institution like the Mayo Clinic or Harvard, Brigham and Mass General, would you support something that's $149,999 per quality? Or would you really look at $30,000 per quality? And unfortunately, it's not a unit that is a catch-all, because I think still to this day, what the intervention matters to people differently, right? So if you have a nephrologist you're talking to and it's a dialysis patient on the other end of the phone, they care about that $50,000 per quality because they want dialysis. And the pediatric cardiologist who's doing, you know, heart transplants wants the $300,000 per quality because that makes sense. So that is really important, the perspective. But in general, from societal tolerances, the idea that in the vast majority of scenarios with ranges of acceptable data variation, because we don't have precise data here, intraoperative monitoring is cost effective in the vast majority of instances.
And I think that's a very good point, because I understand that, yes, cost-effective analysis, it's something that if you're regulating, for example, what is neuromonitoring going to be available for, is Medicare or Medicaid going to pay for it, or is the VA is going to pay? I mean, that seems to be a broad perspective that you can take, and you're dealing with those large numbers. And then probably those decisions involving the costs for qualities, it makes sense because it's your job is proper or optimizing allocation of resources. But I think the whole analysis completely breaks down to the point that it's useless if you're an individual healthcare provider and you're dealing with the decision between using or not neuromonitoring, deciding, okay, am I going to use in every single procedure or other procedures? I mean, all the utility in those cases, they're directly correlated with risk aversion. If I'm someone that is unwilling to tolerate one lawsuit in the next 10 years, yes, I'm going to use everything that is available. And unfortunately, I'm going to have bigger costs for the whole healthcare system. But that's my perspective. And as long as I'm available, I'm self-interested and going to end up using. And I'm not saying that that's the right position. Probably other people who they say, okay, let me decide more on a system base and let me do what I would like other physicians to do, knowing that whatever we decide should be generalizable. So if I don't think that everyone can monitor every single surgery, I'm not going to do that way. So there's a more nuanced perspective, which is a little bit less risk averse. But I get your point, and I think that's very important. I mean, and this is an exercise in public health decision making, and the translation of those results, or even that threshold of $100,000 per quality to individual level decision making. It is just not the same approach that we use when we decide whether to go one way or the other. So thanks
no,
for that
I
comment.
Agree. And I agree. I mean, it's hard not to be individualistic, but I do put on the public health hat from time to time, especially in my research. And, you know, there are certain things that we need to kind of take a step back and say, you know, we want now and generations beyond us to continue providing sustainable care. It is good practice and often evidence-based to offer the best of all averages, to say there are certain scenarios where we have to be the outlier. But in general, the standard of care should allow for this, this, and this, because this is sustainable for the most people.
And that's, I think, is one of the values of your paper. I would say it's less valuable to the individual neurosurgeon who wants to change their practice based on your results. But I mean, especially taking account the North American Spine Society. I mean, when we're devising guidelines about neuromonitoring, and those are the decisions that we're kind of setting the standard, which probably going to be used by those in litigation. I mean, what does the North American Spine Society says about neuromonitoring? Do they recommend neuromonitoring? Do they suggest that it can be possibly used? So I think when we're discussing, even in terms of organized neurosurgery, I think those are the scenarios that your paper is very valuable and a significant contribution to the literature. So I do appreciate your hard work. And thank you very much for coming to our podcast and the very live discussion we had. And we look forward to have more of your studies published in our journal.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure, real pleasure.